Our live was exhausting work. We still have to go to school tomorrow. Lou insisted on sleeping in my bed, even though we were too big to fit comfortably in the twin, and fatigue blanketed whatever discomfort I felt, whatever anxiety weighed on me. This was not a typical Wednesday night, even by the Tran family's non-standard standards. It wasn't every Wednesday night that your parents were so exasperated that they left. In the dark, I awoke. I didn't know if it had been 20 minutes or 3 hours. I heard my parents come in, and I got up, letting Lou sleep. Good for him. I saw my mother first. My father was in the kitchen. I could hear the water running as he got a glass of water. "You came back." I didn't know what else to say, standing by the bathroom. "Thanks for doing the dishes." My mother had noticed the empty sink. "We'll try to be good. I'm so sorry." I started to cry again, but this time from relief. She held my head against her chest. "I know you will." Their suitcases were still at the top of the stairs. "Let me help you." I picked up a suitcase leaning into its weight, but it flew up in my hands and I lost my balance. The suitcase was unexpectedly light. It was empty, in fact. My father came around the kitchen and saw me picking up the empty luggage. They hadn't actually packed their bags. They hadn't planned to leave us. He and I looked at each other as I realized their bluff. My father eyed the suitcases. "I hope you learned your lesson." I didn't reply. Instead, I placed both empty suitcases by their door and went back to our room, closing the door behind me. I pushed Lou, snoring slightly, to make room in my bed. In the dark, I weighed my father's words. Learned my lesson? I did learn a lesson. I had a grand and rosy notion of parents from television. Unconditionally nurturing, kind, loving. The Bradys, the Cunninghams, the Waltons. Television had a Jungian archetype of perfect parenthood that was the yardstick for my parents. And in reality, I had a father and mother from Grimm's fairy tales. Parents willing to beat, forsake, and terrorize children. My parents pretended to abandon us. I believed that they had left. And then, I discovered that they had lied. Which was more monstrous? This painful experience was, in fact, part of the Jungian arc of maturity, the separation from one's parents to become our own individuals. Jung writes, "But in making this break with the childhood world, the original parent archetype will be injured." My image of my parents was injured. I accepted that Chan and Chi couldn't meet the symbolism of idealized TV parents. But at night, in my bed, I still held tight the flint of what I thought good parents were supposed to be. In our family's dark moments, I still needed and wanted fairy tale TV parents. I struck that parental ideal against whatever pebble of hope I had, dreaming that the spark of my yearning would rekindle something in them too. My idea of parents, my ideal of parents, was sputtering and barely alight, but it still smoldered, and I fanned a hope that they could be good parents, that they could be the parents I needed them to be. Learned your lesson. My father's words struck a plangent chord. I did learn a lesson that night. In the void of their departure, I learned to appear greater than I was. My brother needed me to be more than his 9-year-old brother. I learned that even if I didn't have a clue about driving or having a job or being a parent, the symbolism of being a parent, the basic act of making toast and washing plates, was enough for Lou. That was the power of the symbol. November 1983. My uncle, Jutu, was not my real uncle. At least, not in the state that we saw him. In the coffin, Jutu looked grayish, and even though his mustache and hair looked real, his cheeks and eyes were sunken. The effect of his deep-set eye sockets created a face that was my uncle's face, but its features were exaggerated and drawn. Long before I learned about the uncanny valley, I felt the apprehension of seeing something that looked almost exactly like my uncle, but was not my uncle. I shuddered. "Is that Jutu?" Lou was as unsure as I was. We were both dressed in button-down shirts and clip-on ties, ill-fitting blazers and whatever dress pants we had. We wore the same outfits to Christmas Mass and Easter Sunday, though our uncle's funeral was the antithesis of those occasions. Our dress clothes seemed to inaugurate the apices and nadirs of formal gatherings, celebrations, and mournings.
Is it really him?
Yeah, of course it's him.
It doesn't look like him.
I flashed a passing annoyance that he had called Chutu it, but it was exactly the right word. It did not deserve the pronoun he. I nodded. My mother's second eldest brother was dead, and in the midst of the grieving, witnesses to our aunt's tears and Bawai's steely poise, Lou and I were debating the quality of the embalming and makeup, the verisimilitude of the corpse. I was thankful that he hadn't died in a fire. At least we were looking at a relatively normal-looking corpse. It was the second funeral I'd been to, the second dead body I'd seen, third if you count St. John Newman. I was 10 years old, already able to determine the qualitative differences in open casket funerals, and declared that this affair was not as gruesome as Bako's funeral, but it unsettled me nonetheless.
Why did he kill himself?
Lou asked the seemingly unanswerable, but his question exhumed a grim truth. My parents had gone over this already. My exasperation with Lou's relentless questioning made me whisper shout,
"He killed himself because he killed Aunt Cindy. Remember?"
And in the pews, my father gnarred at me and Lou. My uncle Jutu had married Cindy a few years earlier, an American woman, a first for the trans, and they had a daughter, Heather, who was exactly Lou's age. Lou didn't bother to ask my parents, whispering to me,
"Why did he kill her?"
My uncle Tai, Tu's younger brother, had told me why, and I didn't hesitate to tell Lou.
Jutu found her with a boyfriend in bed. I guess he got angry and stabbed and killed her. He stabbed her boyfriend too, but the boyfriend ran away and lived. And then, Jutu killed himself.
But why did he kill himself?
And Aunt Cindy had a boyfriend? I thought they were married.
I couldn't explain that last part because I didn't know much about their relationship. In that actual moment, we were dumb. Divorced from any perspective other than our elementary understanding of love, marriage, death, and murder. I hazarded a guess. Maybe he felt really bad after he killed her. Maybe he felt so bad that he killed himself. Lou seemed to accept that as much as any 7-year-old could.
But it was Thanksgiving. He killed her on Thanksgiving.
I didn't dispute that point of emphasis. Lou was right. Without saying it, he was circling the horror of the event the way that kids do. Name the facts and allow the facts, in all their jagged, incongruous angles, to grind and scrape against one another. Kids don't have a euphemistic or subtle way of speaking about life. You're right, it was Thanksgiving, but I don't know why he did it on Thanksgiving. I didn't want to remind Lou of the worst part. It was also Heather's birthday. It was Thanksgiving and our cousin's 7th birthday, and now both of her parents were dead. Heather wasn't at her father's funeral. Her American grandparents had planned Cindy's funeral on the same day, at the same time, at another funeral home across town. Heather had spent the entire previous summer with us and celebrated family holidays and birthdays alongside us. The death of her parents was the beginning of her slow disappearance, as her American grandparents withdrew from our family, eventually relocating to Florida. We never heard from her again. And poor Aunt Cindy, 26 years old. I thought about how kind she was, how she was always smiling, and how she and my mother would commute together to the electronics factory because my mother had gotten her a job there. My uncle had achieved the American dream, a pretty American wife, a muscle car, a child, a dog, a great job, jackpot. It was textbook blueprint Americana. And he demolished it, all of it. It didn't make any sense to me. Our most successful, most American family member had thrown it all away. His success had symbolized everything we were striving for, and now it ended with an orphaning murder-suicide. I mulled this over as the funeral mass danced with its choreography of standing, sitting, kneeling, praying. Lou leaned over to me every few minutes to share a new thought that he had.
Jutu was... He was really nice.
Lu's ellipses were fraught with the concessive reality that, yes, he was nice, and in spite of that, he also killed his wife and himself. Remember how he took us swimming last summer? At the pool? I did remember. That past summer, Jutu had offered to watch me and Lu because my parents couldn't find childcare 2 days a week. He'd make us lunch, along with Heather, and then we'd all go to the indoor pool at Dickinson College where he worked. We jumped off the high dive, screaming all the way down, the water hitting us so hard that it would wedge our swimming trunks all the way up our butt cracks. Jutu, without swimming trunks, wore cut-off jeans, which attracted brow-raising disapproval from the other swimmers, but he didn't care. Tossing his long hair over his shoulders, reeking of nicotine and nonchalance, Jutu cannonballed right into the deep end. Right off into the deep end. And now he was dead. And the corpse, presented in a polished mahogany box with tufted white satin, was supposed to look like him, but in a coffin. Symbolism in our waking Jungian dream was a two-way mirror. We were symbols for our American neighbors, but our neighbors, with their polished cars, grand homes, backyard swing sets, they symbolized something for us, too. They glittered as goals, mirages toward which we endlessly stumbled. That day, I mourned my uncle as much as I did the American success he symbolized, and I shuddered that the symbolism of the trans was now tinged with blood. March, 1984. Can I change my name? It was Sunday after church. My father shrugged.
Sure. What do you want to change it to?
Neither parent bothered to ask why, because they already knew why. To Americanize, to blend in, to molt a foreign name that was ill-fitting, or that made the process of fitting in ill-fitting.
What? Really? What's your name going to be?
Lou's surprise was laced with excitement. I was thinking I would change my name to Peter. I anticipated the obvious question of why. You know, like Saint Peter, my patron saint. We all got patron saints for our baptisms. Lou had gotten St. Luke, and I had gotten St. Peter. I wasn't sure how my parents or grandparents allocated the patron saints, but I had always been envious that Lou had gotten St. Luke because of Star Wars. Who could possibly be a better patron saint for me, Fook? Our names even rhymed, and Star Wars was my religion. It would have been perfect, but alas, not to be.
Peter? That sounds nice. I like it.
And I like that it's because of St. Peter. My mother approved. My father mumbled assent. My mother had, in the 9 years that we'd been in Carlisle, changed her name 3 times, from Lucy, her patron saint name, to Kim, her middle name, which coincidentally had an Anglonym equivalent, and then to Chi, her Vietnamese name. As she rebranded, she hadn't bothered to update her acquaintances at work, parishioners at church, or our neighbors at Colonial Square. So she was called and replied to all 3 names. My father, Chan, had not changed his name because Chan was easy for Anglophones to pronounce. Meanwhile, my father's youngest sister had recently taken the name Michelle after the Beatles song because Ngalp was too unwieldy for English speakers. And her boyfriend, Chiang, adopted the name Paul, as in McCartney. The Beatles had a hallowed place in our family, and after the Bible, the Fab Four were our first stop for nomenclature. It was divine intervention that we hadn't yet named anyone Sergeant Pepper or Eleanor Rigby. I went biblical and opted for Peter, but truthfully, I had chosen it because of Peter Parker. The association with Spider-Man was cool, and it amplified an otherwise normal American name. The F-word had crept into the Moreland Elementary School playground in 5th grade as middle school approached, and it was not lost on me that my name had an uncanny and unfortunate consonance with the F-word. This was no time for inaction. This was the time to make the change before middle school started, before the F-word would become the shock currency of vulgarity. Over lunch, my family talked about everything except my name change. It was fait accompli. My parents were so amenable to it, I got the impression that they wondered why I had persevered so long with the name Fook. That afternoon, my mother and father ran an errand at the mall, and upon their return, My mother called me into the kitchen.
Hey, Fup, we got you something.
What is it, Ma?
I went into the kitchen.
Here you go. We found it at the card store. It says your name.
Seriously?
Really?
My name?
I was skeptical. My mother handed me a light switch plate that had a little angel painted on it, and in the puffy cloud above the cherub, it said, Peter.
Oh, that name.
Thanks, Ma.
I'll show you how to put it up in your room later. My father was always happy to put a tool into our hands. Lou immediately protested.
Wait, why does Fook get a nameplate for our room? What about me? Where's my nameplate?
I'm older, that's why.
Primogeniture for the win.
And just like that, with a personalized nameplate and a fiat declaration, I was ready to be Peter. The next day at school, I approached my teacher, Mr. Burgess, and told him,
Mr. Burgess, I'd like to change my name. I talked with my parents yesterday and they're okay with it.
Okay, what to?
Peter.
That sounds good. Do you want to tell the class?
Actually, can you tell the class?
I can. Let's do it tomorrow, first thing after the Pledge of Allegiance. Sound okay? I nodded gratefully. The heft and authority of Mr. Burgess's announcement, a teacher's declaration, would give Peter momentum, power, and respect. Peter needed all the help he could get to sputter up off the ground. The next morning, we pledged allegiance to the flag and to the United States of America, the symbol of all symbols for which we stood. Mr. Burgess waited until everyone was seated.
Class, before we get started, I have an announcement to make. Fook is changing his name this year, and from now on, he's asking that we call him by his new name, Peter. So let's say hello to Peter.
A few kids clapped, a few giggled and said, Hi, Peter. I smiled widely. I leaned over to John and said, Like Peter Parker. And in case he didn't get it, I elaborated,
Like Spider-Man.
John nodded.
Yeah, cool, Peter. That's so different from Fook, but it's cool.
Grace tapped me from behind.
But you look like a Fook. We've known you since kindergarten as Fook.
You don't look like a Peter.
She grinned, joking, and we laughed as we got to our workbooks. Peter was officially airborne, smoothly taking off. I was aloft, having thought that Peter's introduction would be a rickety, bumpy launch. The bell rang for recess. A few kids took to calling me Peter right away. I forgot to respond a few times, and so it was both barrels for a while with kids yelling, Peter! Fook! I had to get used to it as much as they did. We were in the midst of a frenzied game of wall ball when it happened. Of course it was going to happen. Did I think it would be so easy? I was in line for wall ball, ready to challenge Ethan Alder, the wall ball king. He served, I missed, and as I dove and fell for the ball, he grabbed his crotch and yelled,
You're out! Suck my Peter, Fook! Oh wait, you changed your name! Suck my Peter, Peter!
The whole line exploded with laughter. I was still lying on the ground.
Suck my Peter?
I looked up at Ethan grabbing at his crotch in triumph.
Oh no.
I lifted myself up, brushing small stones from my knees. No scrapes or cuts. Karen was at the back of the wall ball line, and I shuffled myself into the line behind her.
Is Peter another word for a wiener? I asked her.
Karen giggled.
Yeah, it is. Isn't that funny?
But it wasn't funny. My stomach turned, and I excused myself from the wall ball line to avoid another one of Ethan's humiliating public service announcements of being sucked like a Peter. I found Mr. Burgess at Foursquare with the other teachers.
Hey, Mr. Burgess.
He smiled down at me.
Yes, Fook? I mean, Peter? Sorry, I'll get it right.
Yes, Peter? Actually, I think I'm just going to stick with Fook. Everyone is used to it. Is that okay? I know you just made the announcement, but I think I'll just keep my real name. Even then, I was lying as I said my name, Fook, in the Americanized way. It was real enough, because it was what everyone else said it was.
Are you sure?
He asked. I wasn't sure, but I didn't know what else to do. I couldn't sit down with him or anyone else to ask, What are all the names that I should avoid picking that have an association with genitalia?
Oh,
Well, here's the list. I'm so glad you asked.
I nodded. Yeah, I'm sure. Can you make another announcement that I'm going to switch back to Fook?
Sure. I can do it after the pledge tomorrow morning, okay?
Okay. I had hoped that it would be today.
After the Wednesday morning pledge, Mr. Burgess retracted Peter, reinstated Fook, and school went on as normal. I sighed in relief, and I saw relief among my classmates, too, that they could go back to calling me Fook. Their habits and assumptions having worn deep, predictable grooves in our interactions. Did I think that I could upend their expectations without any resistance? Of course, I was technically the same kid, but I had gotten the message. I couldn't try too hard to change or fit in, especially if it involved something as dramatic as changing my name. That was too much, too symbolic, too real. I told my family over dinner that evening that I was going to keep Fook as my name. They nodded and changed the conversation to something else. They didn't ask why I was reversing my decision, chalking it up to youthful caprice, and I didn't offer any reason. Before bedtime, I got a flathead screwdriver, removed the Peter light switch plate, and put back the old, nameless beige one. Even Lou seemed happy to have things back to normal. The light switch plate was the only object that I ever had with the name Peter on it, a memento of those 2 days. Maybe a person's name was something more than a name. Maybe my classmates needed me to stay Fook. I thought I could leave behind the aggregated discomfort, the misalignment that the identity of Fook had brought, that I could get a fresh start with Peter. I assumed that an American name, especially with superheroic associations, would heal my wounds. By Jung's analysis, my journey had already begun with the wounds. Jung says that the process of becoming an individual begins with a wounding of the ego, and mine was undeniably wounded. Chapter 6. Madame Bovary. August 1984. 7-Eleven glittered with its large glass panes, and through the windows, on the comic rack, I spotted a new issue of Uncanny X-Men. Lou, Tuan, my older teenage second cousin, and I walked into the store, with a collected $8 to spend and no adult to deny us as untethered consumers. The American Dream. At the comic rack, we spun the stand slowly, scrutinizing the month's new shipments of Marvel and DC titles. The Avengers, Hulk, Aquaman, The New Mutants, Green Lantern. I picked two comics, Spectacular Spider-Man and X-Men, after skimming the new issue of Firestorm, The Nuclear Man. In my reverie, Lou and Tuan wandered away, but I eventually found Lou at the Donkey Kong machine.
"Where's Tuan?"
He shrugged.
"Don't know, but don't mess me up. I'm on the fireballs level."
I left my brother furiously button mashing, fireball leaping, and princess saving as I walked past the wall freezers that hummed with Coke cans and Hungry Man dinners. Tuan stood in the back of the 7-Eleven at the wall of magazines. Rolling Stone, Guns and Ammo, Newsweek, Car and Driver, and Time looming over him. A wall of America.
"Hey, there aren't comics over here," I told him.
"Well, except heavy metal, I guess, but those comics are weird."
"I know. I wasn't looking for comics. I wanted to look at these."
He held a swimsuit catalog.
Really?
"Yeah. Look at all these women. This is a good one. Look at this lady." He flashed me the layout of a blonde woman in a standard red one-piece bathing suit. There was nothing overtly erotic about her, other than the fact that she was wearing a bathing suit in the middle of a Carlisle 7-Eleven, smiling warmly. You can almost see her nipple. I grunted in agreement, even though I did not espy the supposed singular nipple, but I wasn't going to argue with him. I was nervous that he was so brazenly ogling these ladies, but he didn't seem to care. Emboldened, I looked over his arm, holding my Spider-Man and X-Men to my side, my childish trophies dimming in the glow of Tuan's beauties. The women were all gorgeous, of course, blondes, brunettes, redheads, all shades of hair in between, purportedly modeling swimwear, but, in fact, titillating teenage boys,
who had no interest in the latest season of Ladies' Beachwear. I stood next to Tuan, feeling flush and moving my comics in front of my shorts in case an ill-timed and unmanageable erection decided to pitch a tent. My comics were a cover for my libido. Maybe the most important thing Spider-Man could do for me right there. That was a superhero's work. I could have walked away, but the siren song of these maidens was stronger than the embarrassment of my sixth-grade boner. Tuan paged through the catalog slowly, on the hunt for a nipple, singular or plural. Being only a swimsuit catalog, it yielded little else, but Tuan was undeterred, poring over the pages, a beachcomber, desperate for peekaboo pennies. 5 yards away from us, the payload of real pornography splayed behind the cashier's counter, in plastic bags, behind a formidable fortress of moral and legal censures. The sign prominently said 18 plus only, and a less than formidable mustachioed clerk with a ratty mullet. From where we stood, we only peeked at the titles and the tops of cover girls, as if they were sawn in half, a lascivious magic show, the black plastic magazine panels shielding our friable innocence from the full frontal nudity. Lou was so good at Donkey Kong, and had at least 3 quarters, that he kept playing while Tuan and I looked through a second swimsuit catalog. We then picked up a copy of Iron Horse, a biker magazine, that brazenly bared women's breasts in grainy black and white amateur photos that readers had sent in of their wives and girlfriends. Tuan mumbled gross as he put the Iron Horse back quickly, repelled by the sagging biker tits, which, astride flaming choppers, were covered in blue tattoos. "Hey," the clerk called to us. "This ain't a library." His declaration lacked conviction, the tired reading of a bad script. "Ain't a library. Y'all gotta either buy the magazines or leave." "Okay." Tuan pried Lou from the Donkey Kong while I laid my 2 comics on the counter and transacted the purchase. 7-Eleven mullet guy slid my comics into a paper bag as I not so subtly leered at the booty behind the counter. Playboy, Penthouse, Hustler, Swank, Jugs. Why the extra G? Penthouse Forum. I had no idea what differentiated one magazine from the other, noting only that their common denominator was the insurmountable barriers between me and their boobs. The faint aroma of adolescent arousal evaporated in the harsh daylight outside the 7-Eleven, and on the way home, I refocused on my comics, walking with Spider-Man opened in front of me while Tuan flipped through the X-Men. Lou squeezed between us, reading both comics simultaneously over our elbows. At our apartment, Tuan and I sat on the front step with the new comics while Lou hopped on his bike and rode a circuit around Colonial Square, looking for the neighborhood kids. We read our comics, stopping to show each other an ad for X-ray glasses or gremlins. We debated Wolverine's ability to slice through anything with adamantium claws versus Spider-Man's agility. They were our superheroes. Interwoven with their powers, deeply written into their narratives, were their tales as outsiders, freaks, exiles, aliens. Were there ever 2 boys for whom comic books were more enchanting? If not us, for whom was intended the make-believe of so much power intertwined with the pain of being so outcast? I couldn't imagine. Tuan said something that broke the spell of superheroes. "You know, I have a couple of Playboy and Penthouse magazines." He spoke without looking up from the comics. "Really?" I let the X-Men fall into my lap. "From where?" "My older brother. Maybe I'll show you next time you're at our apartment." "Seriously?" "You can't have them, though, but you can definitely look at them." And so it began. We didn't know it at the time, but in our own way, we were enacting the predictable teenage rite of bequeathing porn. When he eventually did show me a Playboy and a Penthouse, we huddled in his room with the door closed. He explained to me all the subtleties of the pornos as we leafed slowly past glossy pages of Aquanet and turquoise eyeshadow, breasts and legs pulled in revelatory directions, tasteful props of neoclassical columns to elevate what was otherwise low and guttural. Tuan was a fount of information as well as opinions disseminated as information. He was happy to pontificate and I was eager to take notes.
Why was Penthouse better? Why was Hustler kind of gross? What exactly was Penthouse Forum? What was Swank? Tuan knew, or at least had an opinion on, all of it, even though he only had copies of Playboy and Penthouse. I marveled at how he had access to such verboten knowledge, but the porn pile under his bed did not lie. And even though he couldn't tell me why Jugs magazine required the extra G, he was my first guide at the edge of a forbidden primal wood. I lingered at its threshold, clinging to my comic books and Saturday morning cartoons, but feeling the visceral pull and tug of something fleshier and irresistible. I carry a deep and perhaps unlikely connection to Flaubert's Madame Bovary. I don't have a past life as a disgruntled, quixotic 19th century housewife married to a second-rate doctor in rural France. But the first time I read Madame Bovary, I knew immediately that she and I had a shared passion. In Flaubert's novel, Emma Bovary yearns for a life that is beyond her grasp. Her desire for a grander existence burns from her love of romance novels, and her devouring of these bodice rippers inflames in her an unyielding desire. Nothing in life can satisfy Emma Bovary, and she tragically pursues affairs and extravagances until she has ruined her name and finances. Unable to fulfill her fantastical delusions, she commits suicide at the end of the novel. Her escape from debt collectors, scandal, and the ennui of her marriage. Whence her fantasy? It swirled from her early love of trashy novels. Such is the power of art in Flaubert's world, as he writes, Emma tried to find out what one meant exactly in life by the words bliss, passion, ecstasy, that had seemed to her so beautiful in books. But if literature moves you deeply, does it matter where it comes from? Does it matter that it's trashy or lowbrow? Isn't that emotional connection one of the purposes of art? To make you feel, really feel, emotions? To resonate with your life? And perhaps in that connection, to introduce you to a world that lies beyond your own perspective, the utopia beyond your myopia. My friends and I hunched over comic books with the passion of scholars, analyzing every panel, reading every issue, every word several times over. I looked up innumerable vocabulary words from the pages of my Marvel adventures, in which the heroes cracked wise and the villains always had the time to lather logorrheic illuminations of their dastardly deeds. And beyond my comics, I slipped in between the covers of fantasy books, spiriting away to lands far from Carlyle's quiet corners. A Wrinkle in Time, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I was transported to galaxies far away, times long ago. And between books, I always returned to my comics, my first loves. In the realm of comics, I worshipped my heroes' powers and strengths, lamented their struggles and travails, and then, slowly, I noticed their physicality, their muscularity, their unitards that seemed to be painted on their nude bodies. Was that sexual world spread open by my cousin's initiation? Or by my own libidinous curiosity. My comics now stoked another fantasy beyond climbing walls and retractable claws, as the heroine's voluminous breasts and taut pelvises created Bermuda triangles that my eyes could not evade. Emma Bovary incinerated the tedium of her life with romance novels, and for myself, I had my comic books. And now, I had my cousin's Playboy magazines. Fantasy novels, comic books, porn. I was afire and burning bright. October 1984. Max and I walked home from Lamberton Middle School together, having agreed to meet by the yellow lockers every day after the bell. We both walked the same route to and from school, and in the long parade of pedestrian kids, we bantered about the Karate Kid, the Last Starfighter, or why the 13-minute version of the Thriller video was better than the 3-minute format. I had lent Max the Lloyd Alexander fantasy series, my favorite books, about a young hero, wizards, and a damsel in distress, and we debated whether it was a Lord of the Rings ripoff or not. Quintessential sixth-grade banter. We cut in between buildings and houses, across parking lots and down tree-lined boulevards. As we neared my apartment, Max stopped and dropped his backpack. Oh my God, I almost forgot to tell you. I got the book from my house. Seriously? You got it? Yeah, but let me give it to you now and not near your house. He unzipped his backpack. I lowered my backpack too and, sensing the prurient nature of the transaction, nudged my backpack over behind a small tree, not that it provided much cover. I knelt down next to Max, who was fumbling in his backpack for the book. A week earlier at lunch, Max had told a few of us about a book that he found on his parents' bookshelf. Initially, we were unimpressed by his announcement of, "Guys, I found a book," until he told us. It had sex in it. Descriptive, explicit, copious amounts of sex. This wasn't Judy Blume, skirting and flirting with your changing body, prepubescent, bowdlerized for scholastic intimations of sex. This book was the real thing. This was real sex, from an adult, by an adult, for an adult. We all called bullshit on Max's report of the book, and in classic middle school fashion, we demanded that he bring the book into school. Max had no choice but to do it or forever be infernally branded as a liar, which was one level below the circle of snitches in the hell of middle school. We had unwittingly convened our first book club meeting, although we would only ever read and discuss this one book. In the open air of the sidewalk, Max handed me the book, The Happy Hooker by Xaviera Hollander. I read the spine to myself, not daring to say it aloud. Whoa, you weren't lying. Max was pleased with my awe. Yeah, see? I wasn't lying. Give it to John after you're done. He's next. Okay. Will your parents know that it's missing? No, I don't think so. It was on a bookshelf in the basement. No one ever goes down there. These were the delights of accidental porn. Max happened to go into his basement looking for who knows what, happened to know what a hooker was, and just happened to pick up the book and wade through the exposition long enough to get to the good parts. We weren't literary critics dissecting the authorial voice or insights into human sexuality or its commodification. We were looking for graphic depictions of sex. We had graduated from our elementary giggling about girls menstruating to middle schoolers' inextinguishable libido-fueled curiosity. Amid fusty boxes, Max had found an incendiary spark of a book. I shoved the soft mustard-colored paperback in between red and blue trapper keepers and zipped it up quickly. Thanks. This was the real after-school special. We parted ways at my apartment door and I let myself in with my key. My parents were still at work and Lou was at school, so I hopped on the couch and inspected the cover with its Farrah Fawcett-esque photo of Xaviera. She wasn't unattractive. Chapter 1, page 1. When Lou came home, I immediately hid the book. But after dinner, while the rest of my family watched television, I went back to reading, my parents misunderstanding my interest in reading as academic and not pre-apic. Secluded in my room, I discovered that The Happy Hooker boiled with sexual activity of all varieties, and Ms. Hollander's escapades limned for me countless details and diagrams of coitus that I could not have fabricated. It was one thing to gawp at the glossy photos of my cousin's Playboy. It was another thing to be guided into the wilds of literary sex, lovely, dark, and deep. Passion, bliss, and ecstasy graced the pages of The Happy Hooker. Emma Bovary would have been proud. I read and masturbated furiously that week. And then came the bad part. Chapter 11, page 196. It was after school. No one was home, and I was lying in my bed with my pants undone, one-handed reading. The Happy Hooker was giving a blowjob to an Oriental, her words, businessman. This was still serviceable wank material. But then, she described how his penis was, in fact, a fake penis, because he was embarrassed by how small his actual penis was. After comforting the man, Hollander removed the prosthetic penis and sucked his real dick, which Hollander said was the size of her pinky. She went on to make generalizations about how sex with Orientals was like washing her hands, clean and functional. And then, she said that Orientals were the smallest in dimensions. What? I immediately lost my erection as I read the ensuing description of the man's tiny dick and how it was even smaller than she had expected. If my penis could have shriveled from shame, it would have. I wasn't aware of this stereotype, and now, in the midst of a compelling after-school jerk-off session, Xaviera Hollander, a lady who had seen thousands of dicks, was informing me, and all her readers, that Oriental men had the smallest dicks. I zipped up my pants, not even wanting to see my supposed micropenis. I stopped reading that day and skipped the rest of the chapter. Hoping to suffocate my impressions by piling on more sex scenes, I pressed on to finish the book the following week. John dunned me for the book, and I handed it over to him at school between two locker doors, flung open to conceal our exchange. How was it? Was it as good as Max said? John delighted in his turn to have the book. I nodded, feigning excitement. Oh yeah, it's good. John did read it. He passed it on to Ethan. Ethan passed it on to Stephen. Ms. Hollander's adventures made the rounds, and I had to assume that the entire group would read, or had already read, her observations about Oriental men's dicks being the smallest of all the dicks she had ever had the opportunity to suck. And sucking dicks was her job. I couldn't argue this point, and no one in our ad hoc book club would care enough to challenge any of her observations. And we didn't even talk about the seriously racist stuff in her book, in which she wrote authoritatively regarding stereotypes about Jewish men, black men, Orientals, Irish, and more. We boys had come for the jerk-off material, but I left scarred by and scared of her incontrovertible observations. My only solace lay in my friends being poor or slow or counterfeit readers. Maybe some of the kids at the lunch table didn't read that section or didn't read the book at all, but I wasn't going to give anyone a pop quiz about it. The happy hooker was Madame Bovary in reverse. Instead of a book unleashing my fantasy, a book had circumcised my tumescent libido. I wished I had never read it, but beyond that, I wished that my entire lunch table had not read it. I was the so-called small-cocked Oriental now because of a book, a shitty, terribly written, racist book. And without any recourse to discuss it, we were sixth-grade boys after all, the book circulated and disappeared back into the hole of Max's backpack, safely sequestered in his parents' basement, never to be seen in our circle of jerks again. July 1985, Staten Island, New York. Lou and I walked with our older cousins, Nyung and Hun, accompanying them on their paper route. Nyung and Hun took advantage of our eagerness to win their favor, and this meant that Lou and I did the bulk of the work, carrying and delivering the papers in the midsummer swelter. You looking forward to the movie tonight? It looks good, right? Nyung and Hun were going to take me and Lou to see The Goonies. Cyndi Lauper's radio hit had been on heavy rotation for the last month, and indeed, if The Goonies were good enough for her, they were good enough for me. I was excited equally for the movie and for the occasion to hang out with my older cousins from the big city. Yeah, the movie looks awesome, and it has the Oriental kid from Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. I was referring to Jonathan K. Kwan, who had played Short Round in the Raiders of the Lost Ark sequel. Oriental? Young repeated. Yeah, he's Oriental. I heard he's even Vietnamese. Dude, he's not Oriental. Lou and I were perplexed, and Lou jumped in. Yes, he is. He's in Temple of Doom. Of course he's Oriental. I backed Lou up. Yeah, he's totally Oriental. Have you not seen Temple of Doom? Christ's sake. That's not what we're talking about. Hun's New York accent sounded thicker than usual as he became agitated. Oriental? What the hell is that? He's Asian. He's from Asia. Asia is a continent. There's no continent called Oriental. Jesus. At least say he's Asian if you're not going to say that he's Vietnamese. Nyung jumped in. What the hell are you learning in Carlisle? Frickin' Oriental? He shook his head. That was the question for my lifetime, more loaded than Young's intent to insult small-town PA. What the hell were we learning in Carlisle? With Lou at my elbows, it didn't seem like a good time to mention the frequent usage of Oriental in The Happy Hooker. What was wrong with the word Oriental, I wondered. The adults and kids in Carlisle used the word Oriental interchangeably with Asian and Vietnamese, and by middle school, I avoided the word Vietnamese as much as possible as a self-descriptor. The media associations with the Vietnam War, the vets, the protests, and all the movies gave the word Vietnamese, a swirling, psychedelic miasma of Huey choppers, hippies, and carnage. A prisoner executed in the streets. A naked girl screaming from napalm. Americans protesting a pointless war. Why would I want to associate myself with these things more than I already did? Here, my urbane cousins nudged open the door of a different world for me to peer into. In Carlisle, the trans were indiscriminately Oriental, Asian, or Vietnamese. But in New York, a preference muscled itself in between the words Oriental, Asian, and Vietnamese. Was there a hierarchy of what was appropriate or accurate? Pejorative connotations for one and not the others? I knew none of this, and I shrugged, accepting the distinction as gospel, with my cousins as the evangelists crying out in the wilderness of New Dorp, Staten Island. They were on the vanguard of something I had yet to understand, but I was willing to carry the good news back to Carlisle. Hallelujah, I was Asian, not Oriental. I wanted to clarify. So, we're Asians or Vietnamese, but not Orientals. Right, you're not Oriental. Rugs are Oriental. What are you, a rug? Young's sharp sarcasm punctuated his question, and Lou and I nodded at his tutelage before going inside. Asian had a grand, wider association. China and Japan. Saturday Kung Fu films. Bruce Lee. Chinese food. Indiana Jones's sidekick. Asian sounded cool. We had family dinner with all the adults, and then we were off to the movies. On the drive back from the Goonies, we rattled off the wasn't it cool when moments of the movie while circling our delight in seeing an Asian slash Vietnamese, but not Oriental kid on the big screen. I immediately wanted to see it again. This was not a movie about the war. We weren't antagonists or some faceless platoon of Charlie lurking in the jungle foliage. We were kids looking for adventure, and someone in Hollywood saw a place for us in the movies. We were exuberant to see a character who looked like us, cheering him on in his adventures and exploits. But then, when Lou said that he couldn't understand data because of his thick accent, I winced because I knew that Lou was right. Even as Data stood there, 12 feet high on the screen, he was still part of Hollywood fiction. His bad English made him an obvious and familiar foreigner. He was the tech-slash-math whiz, but he was a sidekick, a figure at the edges, bumbling and hamming it up for laughs. But at least he wasn't a Viet Cong, and at least he kind of saved the day. I'd take it as a win, even if it was a Pyrrhic victory for us. Emma Bovary's books made her yearn for a dream world of emotional dramas and searing affairs. They seeded a delusion in her that grew quickly and blinded her, choking out the light, except for the glow of fictitious hope. She was not ready for the quiet boredom of a married woman's life, and the yearning that flourished inside her made her own life repulsive to her. Could art do that? Could it make you long and loathe at the same time? I know I did. I longed for power and acceptance and sex just as Emma did. I loathed a cultural landscape that had only a narrow, slant-eyed space for me. And in that loathing, I couldn't see changing that landscape. A lumpy mass of American stereotypes was metastasizing inside me. It made me cringe when I heard Mr. Miyagi say, "Wax on, wax off, Daniel-san." It made me pretend to laugh when I saw Long Duk Dong in 16 Candles. It made me sign up for Taekwondo that year because that was what Asians did. It would be decades before I diagnosed the lump of alienation, dual consciousness, and self-hatred, but it was already growing quickly, bilious and caustic. I only saw myself as the piece that did not fit in the puzzle. At the end of our New York visit that week, we waved goodbye to my cousins from the rear window. I settled into the back seat and pulled out the third book from the Narnia series, settling in for a 4-hour drive home to Carlisle. Lou was flipping through an Aquaman comic, and my parents Vietnamesed in the front seat. Unable to read, I closed the book to watch Staten Island skitter by, to me so exotic and foreign. Bodegas, kosher delis, signs in Spanish and Chinese and Hindi. Carlisle had already stitched in me a provincial mindset, and the dense tapestry of New York, the noise, the trash, the expanse, enthralled me. I held the Realm of Narnia awaiting in my lap as I admired the lights from the Gothel's Bridge into New Jersey, hoping to catch a glimpse of a New York landmark as the traffic slowed at the toll. The smudgy, glittering cityscape as alluring and fantastical as anything in C.S. Lewis's wardrobe. In a long line of cars, we were suspended in the air, and Lou and I craned our necks now, looking down at the swirling gray waters, the blinking lights of planes arriving at Newark in the distance. All that adventure out there. I played with the adjustable snaps on the back of one of the New York Mets baseball caps that my aunt and uncle had given to me and Lou. I put it on and noticed that Lou was already wearing his cap. That was the nature of siblings. We always got two of everything. Lou looked at me. "Hey, you look like Short Round from Temple of Doom. He has the same hat." "Oh yeah, I guess you're right." I looked at Lou and slid my hat off, feeling embarrassed that he immediately said that I looked like Short Round. The truth, however, was that when I saw Lou with his hat on, I thought that he looked like the Asian kid from Gremlins in the Chinatown pawn shop. I became saddened as I realized it must have been a coincidence, right? Was it on purpose? Short Round and the nameless Gremlins kid, they weren't the same actor, and the movies didn't happen in the same timeline. Temple of Doom took place in the 30s, and Gremlins happened in 84, but I connected the dots. Both Asian kids wore New York baseball caps. Those kids looked the same in those two movies, because the audience looked at them the same. The movies were doing the work of America, ghettoizing us in our own minds, a slow and delicious poison like Emma Bovary's novels. Our imaginations, our self-reflection, were circumscribed by what we saw, limited and funneled into someone else's view of who we were. We saw ourselves as others saw us, and when we were in the media, which was not frequent, our stereotypes were reinforced in the books we read, the movies we saw, the things our friends said to us. In the backseat of our Ford LTD, Lou and I saw each other for a moment through the lenses of movies that we loved and movies that we yearned to see ourselves in, even as we were squeezed into the box of not belonging. My cousins may have deleted Oriental from my vocabulary, but not Orientalism from my mindset. Getting rid of the O word was only a symbolic fight. The word was gone, but that didn't mean that the idea was vanquished. I retired the hat into my pack and opened Narnia in the fading light of dusk. C.S. Lewis's world, the world of literature, seemed less specific, less explicit to me. I could see myself on a quest, unsheathing a sword, mounting a daring escape, the outlines of the book's heroes more opaque and far-fetched to me. When we got home to Carlisle, I put my Mets hat in my closet, ignoring Lou's endearing request that we wear the hats to match. I didn't want to look exactly like Lou. Two more Asian kids in New York baseball caps? It's how they already saw us. We just had to look at the movies. Chapter 7. Pygmalion. 1986. At Lamberton Middle School, I nervously noted the emergence of social spheres, their barriers rising up from the tectonic shifts of hormones, genders, and interests. In sixth and seventh grades, my friend group was a collection of comic book nerds. They were big-time nerds, and entering stage left, I was the Tolkien Asian of that nerd herd. For my seventh-grade home economics sewing project, I stitched for myself an X-Men throw pillow. I bought a four-pack of VHS tapes and recorded episodes of Robotech at my grandparents' apartment after school every day. Weekend after weekend in middle school, it was us boys hanging out, playing Dungeons & Dragons, debating comics, painting small lead figurines for our dungeon maps, or watching B-horror films like The Return of the Living Dead. At the edges of our consciousness swished the popular girls and the cool boys, demigods and mermaids at the borders of mythical maps. We were content to keep to ourselves and our 12-sided die. At Lamberton's spring dance, the cafeteria was transformed into a darkened makeshift dance floor, with its folding tables pushed to the perimeter and sparse streamers strewn haphazardly over light fixtures. I stood with Craig and Derek in a tight circle, staring past their heads at the slow dance on the cafeteria cum dance floor. Madonna's Crazy for You gyrated over the PA speakers. In our coterie, I pretended to listen to Craig's tirade about the latest advanced D&D module while I stared at the dancers and gawked at the girls. I surveyed my geeky inner circle. My dissatisfaction struck me hard, there with the sparkling synthesizers cascading and Drakkar Noir oozing in the air. I wanted to break free from the nerds of the round table. I wanted to take on this advanced module, Girls and Dating. I didn't know if I had enough experience points or charisma, but I had the hormonal drive and the naivete to roll the dice. With my friends still more interested in slaying orcs, I needed a different alliance. But how? I'd spent so much time looking for and making friends, and I had them. And now I was apprehensive because I didn't know how to leave a friend group. Did people even do that? It seemed cruel, superficial, but necessary. Where is the blueprint for this conversation? Any compassion and kinship I felt for my friends was countered by a bubbling awareness of girls and their growing awareness of boys. It's not you, it's me. Actually, it's not me either. It's girls. They're yokoing our band, boys. That was how seventh grade ended, and over the summer of 1986, we moved across town. My parents had bought a house, and against my relatives' encouragement that my parents abandon Carlisle altogether for a more cultured environment, Chan and Chi bought a house on the north side of town. Our new neighborhood meant that Lou and I would be enrolled in new schools. My small worries about changing schools were eclipsed by my opportunism. I had hopes for my new school. At Wilson Middle School, I could break free from the chains of nerditude. Eighth grade in 1986 was the middle arc of adolescent Darwinism. We were amoebae in elementary school, gradually growing some spines when we entered middle school. But now it was going to be eighth grade. Everyone's genus and species in the natural pecking order was ossifying, evolving for high school's law of the jungle. Jocks, preps, freaks, geeks, rednecks. I was determined to make an evolutionary jump, if not into a cool kingdom, at least out from the nerd phylum. In the summer of 1986, as eighth grade at Wilson Middle School loomed ahead, I saw my opening. I didn't have to be a nerd anymore, but I wasn't entirely sure how to join another group either. I knew that I didn't want to attempt a name change again. I assumed that my new peers wouldn't allow it, and I didn't want to start off Wilson Middle School with a humiliating backpedaling. I was resigned to being Fook. But in a new school, in a new context, could I change who Fook was? Could I change who everyone thought Fook was? I would try. I just had to figure out who I wanted to be. In George Bernard Shaw's play, Pygmalion, Henry Higgins, professor of linguistics, takes in a common street girl, Eliza Doolittle, and makes a bet with a friend. He wagers that he can pass Eliza off as royalty by teaching her how to speak English properly. Higgins asserts that her low societal status is determined by her working-class dialect and her clothes. Shaw's critique of the English class system propels the play, and bigger questions spin from the hub of the play's central question. Can you authentically move from one social group to another? Is your social status immovable, or is it a matter of changing your speech and stripes? Or in my case, changing schools? And could changing schools allow me to change my social group? Would I need to change my clothes too? I was going to find out if I could be an Eliza Doolittle. At the end of the first week of school, I brought my skateboard on the bus, intent on skating home. I had bought the skateboard from my new neighbor, Richie Johns, a high school kid who was happy to sell it for weed money, and he showed me a few tricks and hand plants on curbs. I couldn't ollie so well, but I could skate fast and carve along the road, and at the end of the first Friday of the school year, a warm fall day, skating home seemed more fun. "Hey, cool deck. That's the Vision Gator deck. I've never seen that color before." I looked up to see Liam Mahoney, a kid I had met the year before in Taekwondo. Liam wasn't in any of my classes, and we hadn't crossed paths in school yet, But nonetheless, I was relieved to see a face I knew in a week's endless tide of unfamiliar faces.
Oh, hey Liam, you skate?
Yeah, me and my older brother. You know Dylan, from Taekwondo. You should come over after school. We're all skating in front of my house. Meet me out front after the bell.
He and I clasped hands, thumbs up to affirm. Blue eyes, big teeth, shaved head on one side and shaggy blonde hair on the other. Liam would be my first friend who openly didn't give a shit about school and wasn't afraid to say so, an attitude that I found terrifying. His stride had a pronated wobble from a perennially ingrown toenail, but oddly, not when he skated. I was thrilled to be skating home from school, and doubly so to be doing it with a friendly face. At the end of the day, the bell rattled its last haranguey clang, and Liam and I met at the bus loop and skated over to his house, a mile from school. We stopped at a ubiquitous 7-Eleven along the way and bought Slurpees before arriving at his house, huffing up a small hill, our hands flashing red and cold. Liam's brother, Dylan, a 10th grader, was already skating in front of their house with four other high school kids. Backpacks were strewn around on the sidewalk, and everyone was taking turns at a stretch of chewed-up curb, loudly landing their ollies with a clack. At any other time, I would have crossed the street as a precaution or turned my skateboard around to steer clear of kids who looked like them. I knew enough to spot the uniform of high school miscreants, ripped jeans, black Converse sneakers, flannel shirts tied around their waists, two of them shirtless, all of them swearing. My heart's panicked baseline throbbed as I skated nonchalantly with Liam into their midst. No one asked me my name or said hi. I got a few nods of approval at my deck, which I didn't know needed approval, but I was happy to receive it regardless. That was the extent of my introduction, and I saw no need to walk around and shake anyone's hands or say my name like an idiot. Hello, I'm Fook Tran. How was your educational experience today? I told myself to shut up and be cool. On his skateboard, Liam tried to ollie and grind on the curb, but he missed and fell headlong. Dylan laughed. Way to go, you fuck nut, Dylan called out, slow clapping ironically. Fuck off, Liam retorted, his two middle fingers punctuated his imperative. Let me show you how it's done. Dylan skated up to the curb to ollie to a grind, the same trick as Liam's. But before he did it, Liam fired his cherry Slurpee at Dylan. With a wet puking sound, the styrofoam cup sluiced its contents all over Dylan's back. You motherfucker! Dylan picked up his board and tomahawked it at Liam as the rest of us abruptly cut our laughter and took cover. Dylan's deck whizzed over the group as some of us covered our heads and others covered our crotches, a revelation of everyone's varied priorities to protect either brains or balls. Liam was unscathed. I'm gonna fucking kill you! Dylan, heavier and slower, chased Liam back and forth across the street. I would later find out that this was a typical afternoon in front of the Mahoney's house. Liam and Dylan were the stock fighting Irish brothers. When they weren't punching the shit out of each other, they were best friends. If you picked a fight with one of them, you were sure to get a boot to the head from the other. Dylan, pink and sticky, chased Liam, who left a vapor trail of soprano cackling in his wake. Dylan caught and wrestled Liam into a headlock on their front lawn, and I couldn't tell if their obscenities were playful or rancorous. No one had a bloody nose yet, so we sat back and enjoyed the bout of impromptu fisticuffs. Fuck you. No, fuck you. Get the fuck off. Fuck you, you piece of shit. You got fucking cherry Slurpee all over me. A woman's head popped out from their screen door, a matronly cuckoo clock to announce the end of the round. Mrs. Mahoney. Knock it off, you two. Knock it off. Oh, hello, boys. Liam and Dylan let each other go, and everyone waved to Mrs. Mahoney. The boys went back to popping ollies, and I skated around, occasionally taking a shot at a homemade curb launch that rocketed me a stunted 6 inches into the air. Sometimes I'd land with confidence. Sometimes I fell. Everyone was practicing tricks with mixed success, and no one seemed to care who fell as long as you didn't bitch about it. The guys hurled the useless encouragement of, "Don't be a pussy." I took in the whole spectacle with awe and realized that these were the boys who I wanted to hang out with. They were clearly the opposite of my erstwhile nerd friends. Group talk, a natural extension of group think, moved on from skate tricks to who was a poser and wasn't a poser. Did you see that kid with that deck from Hills? What a poser. Yeah, and that other kid, the one with the tail guard, that kid's a total poser. I saw him with a helmet on once. What a fucking poser. I didn't know anyone's name, so I kept quiet and listened. I inferred that a poser was someone who skated but was not a real skateboarder. They only posed with their board. Note to self, don't put a tail guard on your deck, and definitely no helmet if I didn't want to look like a poser. But apparently, some accessories on your skateboard made you a poser while others didn't. The ballooning philosophical question of authenticity had floated up, inflated with the hot air of its self-appointed wranglers. They were the ones who decided, the ones who steered it. Was I a poser? I figured if I were, the group would have let me know with withering clarity and profanity. It seemed that I was allowed to skate with them on probationary status, non-poser status, until otherwise rescinded. We skated along the block, popping up and down the curbs until the last of the warm September light stretched our shadows across the darkening pavement, the smell of the asphalt cooling with an autumn prelude in the air. I slung my backpack over my shoulders and clacked my board, wheels down, to head home. No one in the group had directly asked me my name, but it didn't matter. No one had told me to fuck off either, and that was good enough for my first day with new friends. About 5 yards off, Liam called out to me, "See you next time, dude." I gave him a faux military salute. Dylan and a few of the other kids gave their valedictions. "Yeah, see you next time." One of them grabbed his balls and chortled. I gave him the middle finger, and from behind, I heard them all laughing in approval. I grinned out of view, having avoided the pothole of poser status. It didn't matter that they didn't know my name. They welcomed me into their midst with vile gestures and vulgar expressions. And they said, "See you next time." That was the best thing I had heard that first week of school, and I was elated to have a potential group of friends who were cool. Real versus poser. The amorphous idea of being a real skater was a hazy obstacle in my path. I hadn't consciously chosen to be a nerd, but had somehow drawn those numbers in the social lottery of 6th and 7th grade. This never mattered to me until I cared, and the weight of this sudden awareness suffocated me. I cared about how people saw me, how people saw my group of friends, what they said about me, and I was now afraid and worried about it. I now knew that I wanted to be a skater, but wanting that was not good enough. The group could still deem me a poser based on its standards, thereby making me a wannabe. If a social group hated anything more than someone who didn't belong, it was someone who tried too hard to belong. Naked ambition was a form of nudity that was unwelcome to 8th grade boys. Being yourself was not good enough to move up in the world. Eliza Doolittle and I knew that much, at least. April 1987, Friday. I waited outside the hallway of the vice principal's office. The last time I was in the principal's office, I was at Moreland Elementary School, triumphantly eating a McDonald's Happy Meal. This was not a Happy Meal scenario. I got a note that morning at the end of third period that the vice principal wanted to see me. Crap. I knew exactly what it was about. As I waited, I deliberated what I would say to him. Conjured from the pages of a Dickens novel, Wilson Middle School's vice principal was ironically named Mr. Friend. Mr. John Friend, a mustachioed, middle-aged man who always wore a gray suit and a red power tie. Mr. Friend, a Michael Douglas lookalike, his hair parted and his stride cock-of-the-walk confident. I was summoned out of the waiting area and into his office, which was furnished with an obligatory and overly large fern and American flag in the corner. A placard that declared Friend on his desk signaled his name and status as good cop. "Okay, sit down, He looked at a legal pad, his auburn mustache twitching as he spoke. Tran?" I nodded. "Okay, Tran. Listen to me." He didn't know which was my first or last name and had clearly flipped a mental coin. "Do you know why you're here, Tran?" Textbook first move in interrogation. ask your questionee what he thinks you know. No, Mr. Friend, I have never been in trouble or had any detention or anything before at Lamberton. I mentioned my old school, hoping that I could emphasize that I was still too new a student to be involved in any nefariousness.
Well, I heard reports that you're organizing a fight. A big fight. I don't know if it's true or not, but you need to call it off.
But, faint denial.
I don't care. The police have been notified and they'll be around after school today, after the bell. If anything happens, anything, you're going to be back in my office and we'll be talking with the police and your parents. Are we clear? No fight after school. Get the word out to your friends.
I nodded nervously and stood. The police? This was serious.
You seem like a good kid, Tran. I don't want to see you back here.
He put his hand on my shoulder, flashing a large class ring with a deep-set garnet the size of my biggest two knuckles. I felt the weight on my shoulder. Yes, sir. I won't be back in here.
Good.
He had been right about the fight. We were preparing for a huge brawl after school that day. But I wouldn't have used the word organizing. I would have said escalating. Here's what I hadn't told Mr. Friend. On Monday that week, Travis, an eighth grader whose biological clock had already wound him forward with a beard and a smoking habit, had shoved me into the lockers. In my peripheral, I saw mullets and acid-washed denim hemming my way. I smelled hairspray, Old Spice, and Marlboros. I knew that I was going to have to fight someone. Travis and his two cronies had ducked into my locker row, and they decided I was their fodder that week. I squared up with him, and we exchanged some emasculating classics like pussy, faggot, and bitch. I got the standard tirade that began and ended with gook. Those were fighting words. They stepped forward, and I didn't back down. Before any blows were thrown, I felt someone else sneak up next to me, and I pivoted to the side to avoid the ambush, ducking my head instinctively. It was Liam Mahoney,